Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, hello. I got a little signal that I'm not communicating too well to my wonderful audience today. It came from Skype. That we had a weak signal, but I'm sure I will hear if that is continuing. It's really, 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 really good to be talking to you again today. And today is December 5th, 2018. If you happen to be listening on this day, we will be taking live callers, as we always do. And you're listening, if you don't know, because you could be hearing this from many sources, on prn.fm. It's the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. And it's every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. New York time. And if you're interested in listening to the show at your own leisure, we have this show and hundreds of others archived, and you can get to them very directly at breggin.com, and you can search the archives for shows of the people you might love to hear and find that I've interviewed them. Because if they're cutting edge in the reform field, I very likely had them on many, many times. So welcome to the show again. And I have a very exciting listener, because I've really kind of broken the mold. Oh, and by the way, you can call in. Call in on 888-874-4888. It's never too early to call in and get your place in line. And we'll be talking about a wide range of things, because today, let me see if she's there. Sarah, are you there?
I certainly am.
Oh, and you sound clear as a bell. Well, today, and I'm not going to introduce her yet, but today is a big day because my guest was actually a caller. I met her on the air, and she called in a number of times and really added to the show, to the discussion, to what she had to offer herself. So I've invited her today, and some of you already know Sarah from California. If you've listened to the show before, now you're going to get to meet Sarah in depth. And just going on with more about the show and making sure you know everything about it you need to know, you can email me at BregginLive@hotmail.com. Breggin Live. I love that. BregginLive@hotmail.com. And I do read the emails, and I learn from them. I get ideas about what to do. And if any studies are mentioned on the air, you'll find them on Daily Breaking News, because we have another feature, very underutilized so far, but it's a breaking daily news or daily news or fresh news or things like that. You'll find it on the website. So we're just offering tons of different things, and got a very, very lively, growing website. I want to talk about two or three things before get to further introduce Sarah to you. And Sarah can comment on any of these too, as my guests do. My last frequent alert, which you can sign up for on Breggin.com, www.breggin.com, my most recent one, is on an idea that I'm really exploring and testing and looking at. And that idea is that most emotional disorders, most things we diagnose, nearly all that stuff is related to love. It's related to our inability or our woundedness around love. And it's in expressing and feeling love, and about our accepting love and feeling the love we're given. And that this is not just about romantic love, it's about family love of all kinds. That's often very central. Most people who come for therapy are experiencing their problems in terms of family conflict. And that is easily translated into helping the family learn to share and express love and to accept love. It's just not easy for people to do that. So go to Bregan.com and take a look at my blog, and you can write a comment on the blog, which actually sits on Madden America, but you get to it through my website. And that blog now has stirred up like 150 responses, comments, and it's probably going to hit 10,000 viewers pretty soon. Another thing on my website is I've now emphasized and put higher on the website my three courses with Pam, and two of them are brand new. One of them is the Consumer's Guide to Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and the other is part one of How to Help People. And then there'll be part two, and part one of How to Help People, and then part two is How to Help Other People. Well, part one, let me get it straight, is How to Help Yourself, and part two is How to Help Other People. So that's up, and you can buy those and listen to them. You got very good descriptions of them. And the wonderful thing is that Pam Popper, who has encouraged me to do this and organized it and set it up, Pam has allowed me to put up her direct email and her phone number. And I think the best thing is to email her if you have any questions about the blogs. You don't have to fight your way through her website. You can just read what I say about the courses and see if they interest you. And then you can call Pam and she'll tell you all about them, what they cost, what the differences are among them. So one of them is The Heart of Being Helpful, about helping yourself and then helping others. Another is A Consumer's Guide to Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. And then the one that's been on for a year now is a very intensive course on psychiatry and psychiatric drug withdrawal. And that one is pretty spectacular. I've got about 25 videos that go on it. Pam has some videos about healthy living. And we have a young psychiatrist, Pinar Miski, who does the course live in addition to the course materials once a week for quite a long period during the year. And then I'm coming on live. Last year I only came on live once. I'm going to come on live several times onto this course, so you get to talk to me in a conference call with the other members. So I'm doing lots of interesting things. And don't forget Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, while I'm talking about this. My wife tells me I just don't push my books enough. So remember Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, which is my contribution to what causes human personal and emotional misery and how to overcome it, how to identify painful emotions, what to do about them, how to reject them, how to replace them with principled living, with love, with living where you engage the universe with love. Could be your family, could be God, could be the work you do, could be nature, but it's engaging. And I want to thank folks for all the appreciation I'm getting. I got a wonderful essay from Nina, whom I asked her to send me one on air. I want to acknowledge that. I don't think I've written to her yet, so I hope she's listening. And I'm trying to figure out what I might do with a lot of the wonderful commentaries I get. And I think I might, and you can write to me if this sounds interesting and affirm, and I think I might, when I get permissions, I might start putting up some of the comments that people send me, not just the wonderful ones about my work, that's much loved and appreciated, but like Nina's commentary, a discussion about her experiences with family members in psychiatry and her experience. So I'm thinking about setting up a commentary section for the show. Let me know what you think about that. It's, you know, it's keeps me busy, all these different things, and I just have to figure out what looks the best and the most interesting. And pretty soon, folks, from my home, I'll be doing videos and then interactive videos with guests. That's going to start soon. I've got the home visit, the home studio set up now, and it's not going to look like a studio. I had professional consultants, and they all want backdrops and this and that. But I'm going to use basically the equipment I use for the radio show, plus a camcorder. And so you're going to be right in my home office where I'm comfortable, where I dress like more or less like I'm at home. And you can see some of the stuff that I surround myself with. So those are the directions I'm going in. I thank this opportunity with the really wonderful people out in this audience and the wonderful guests and Jesse, who runs the PRN FM. Alex, who just handles the questions so well. So remember, we don't have any questions yet. That's very unusual, maybe because I'm talking so much. But call in 888-874-4888 for questions, and 888-874, same thing, 4888 to make comments. You know, join the show, and we usually have you stacked up like airplanes, and Alex brings you into landing. So my guest, Sarah, you've been listening. My guest is Sarah P. Hancock. Sarah's, are you there? Are you still hooked in?
I sure am.
Oh, yeah, you sound good, too. Sarah is a certified rehabilitation counselor. She's got a master's level certificate in psychiatric rehabilitation. I just think it's really interesting, these alternatives that aren't fundamentally medical. I think the hope of the world is with people who are doing these alternative, and this is not really alternative, but who are doing approaches that focus on the psychosocial and educational. And she's a researcher and a freelance writer. She's doing a lot of constructive things in her community. She has lectured, I think she's lecturing more than I am here. She's got 70 times that she's lectured to 10 different universities in the greater San Diego area. I need to get out to San Diego, Sarah. I got an attorney out there that I'm working with really closely, and maybe sometime we'll get to meet out there. She works
in substance.
That would be fun. Substance abuse areas, just all kinds of different things. Also of interest, and she could tell you about that, is a 70-hour course to train family support specialists. I can't think of anything more important than training people who know how to support families. We know that that is the most effective treatment for people, including people with a psychosis. So it's going to work even better with people who have less overwhelming distress to deal with. I mean, what works best is for everybody is fundamentally the same thing. The more distressed the person is, the more you have to dig deep, and the more you have to try to involve potentially loving family members. But the fundamentals, I think, are the same. Do you think that's the case, Sarah? Why don't we just start with that thought? Do you have the same idea that everybody basically needs the same thing in the way of help for whatever ails, and has to come from a very similar place?
I think that many people can receive phenomenal help from an empathetic environment. An environment which listens to them and which doesn't see them through the lens of a diagnosis. I think there's a variety of causes that contribute to symptoms. And so being able to at least provide a recovery environment and helping the person find hope and helping them develop their ability to make positive choices and then be accountable for those choices is really an empowering experience, which will help the person move forward in their recovery journey.
And do you think this is true across the board for different people, whether it's drug addiction or people who are lapsing into psychosis or a man or woman who wants to improve their marriage? Do you think that things are fundamentally similar? And feel free to disagree with me in what we offer them.
As humans, I think every single human can benefit from having a very strong relationship and understanding that those around them accept them for who they are, as they are. They might not approve or agree with what they're doing, but as a human being, they're accepted. And I think so often we, as humans, we have a tendency to look at perhaps what we've done in the past or what has been done to us, and we get so caught up in that that we forget our own identity, that of who we are. In my perspective, from my cultural and spiritual upbringing, I believe that we're children of God. And when we lose that perspective and we get caught up in all of these distractions of what's happened to us or what we've done and how we've been wronged or how we've wronged others, then we lose the sense of self. And so when we can be in an environment where we have that unconditional love, that can strengthen everyone.
Go ahead.
When I was going through all of my weirdness, I was lost basically to humanity for about 12 years. And then I finally started learning some wellness tools and learning how to kind of navigate my life. And when I met my husband and we got married, my dad pulled him aside and said, you know, I just want you to know you're probably the best medicine Sarah's ever been on. So I think for sure, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the symptoms a person's experiencing, having that relationship with someone where you don't have to question whether or not they appreciate you or value you, and which is going both directions equally, is really crucial to having being able to move someone forward.
I think this is so, so true, and I think there's just no way around it. And it fits very well with this growing emphasis I have on, love being the central issue in why we succeed and fail in life. And a man can, or a woman can be very wealthy and want to die. They can have successes that other people greatly admire, and they can hate their lives. But it's very – well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Yeah. And similarly, or the other side of it is a person who has a love for life and who has loving relationships – in life, can sustain all sorts of deprivation, insult, harm, and serious illness, and even face death in a way that still feels to them like they're having a satisfying life as long as they're alive. I just can't overemphasize that. And I'm getting a lot of people agreeing with me, you know, on the new blog, and then there's some people who are talking about that, which again you can get with my going to Bregan.com and look at my most recent frequent alert. It's free, and you can just go to that blog. And there's some good criticisms of it, which I'm going to respond to in a follow up. People raising questions about it, and I'm really happy for that at this point, because I'm going further in this direction than I've ever gone. And do you ever you do work with families? Tell us about that, because I think that's incredibly important.
When I was working at NAMI San Diego, we had just gotten a grant from the state of California OSHPED department, and it was to develop a curriculum for training family support specialists. And so what I did was I took the curriculum from other locations, took the core competencies from about 12 different family support specialist trainings, and did like a crossroads analysis, found what they had in common, found what we'd like to augment, and then created a curriculum, a 70-hour curriculum, to help people understand how to better support their loved ones. So I taught that in San Diego when I worked at NAMI, and then that has since been moved on to NAMI, California. They're actually, some of the things have been changed, but I still do presentations on the HIPAA and code of ethics and the recovery model as part of a webinar series.
Well, I have one question about NAMI. First of all, I mean, did NAMI, which is the used to be the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, takes money from the drug companies and it supports the drug companies. Did they insist on that being a part of what you were doing?
It was really interesting because I didn't have anyone really overseeing what I was doing. And so I did not incorporate those kinds of things into the curriculum. I focused primarily on the core competencies and did not go into the medication or the drugs or the side effects. But it was interesting because I was bringing a lot of my perspective on recovery, and that was very jarring for some of the people. I know the co-facilitator in the class, she was like, no, recovery is not possible. And I just looked at her and I said, you're looking at someone who's been through 37 different combinations of medications, who's been through more than 100 UCT treatments, who finally got herself together, found herself, and went to graduate school, graduated, and now teaches at a university. Recovery is possible. I'm the evidence. So we would have these kind of go things that would go back and forth. But I think ultimately my training was so recovery-oriented that NAMI San Diego chose not to forward that curriculum on to NAMI California.
Wow. Is the curriculum being used anywhere?
No, I believe it is currently in a file somewhere. I have it myself, and I'd like to adapt it so that I can go ahead and move forward with it. Without any problems, and you know, like intellectual copyright type problems. But yeah, that's right now it's been either recycled or round filed or set on a shelf.
Well, you changed the name of it and changed some of it, but you're clearly the author. So that's very interesting. I really did guess correctly, didn't I? Yeah, NAMI is one of the most destructive forces in the mental health field. Here I didn't even know they were so destructive that they held the idea that recovery was not possible. Boy, does that fit with having to go and get mental health services and psychiatric drugs for the rest of your life. What a deadly, awful thing to tell people. My God. I'm sure that gave you a cold chill or some other equivalent of dismay when you heard that. Is that an official policy somewhere? Is that written down somewhere?
No, I think it's just a systemic issue. It's not that they say recovery is not possible. They're embracing the idea or the concept of recovery, but they're thinking that the only way to attain recovery is through a very specific funnel. And so, like, it was just kind of strange because I've actually taught about the recovery model in meetings here in San Diego, and we have an Ask the Doctor class there, and where a psychiatrist, like a resident from UCSD, comes and answers people's questions. And it was so amusing because I had just presented at Grand Rounds and the community psychiatry program, and one of the residents came and did the Ask the Doctor questions, and someone asked him, is recovery possible? And he said, no. And I looked at him and he looked at me and I just kind of smiled. And then he just kept talking. And I was like, oh my goodness, what is going on with these people? Why are they so, they're just so determined to believe that recovery is not possible. And, you know, for the longest time, I thought recovery meant just finding who you are and becoming all you could with what you had. And since then, I've discovered so many wellness tools, radically altering my diet, you know, and learning so many coping strategies that I really sincerely, honestly feel that recovery and healing is possible.
Well, of course it's possible. I mean, I'm an example of that too. I'm not going to go into the details of what I recovered from, but yes, of course recovery is possible. Recovery is the goal. And in, when I was in training, that would have been, I mean, that would have been considered an evil thing to say, that recovery. We saw our patients recover all the time. And that is when I was in upstate New York, where Tom Szasz was, and where there was an influence of psychological, social, and ethical principles in how we treated patients. And it was assumed your patient got well and left the hospital and didn't necessarily follow up at a clinic even, or if they went to a clinic, it certainly wasn't going to be interminable. This is the reason why they believe this is A, it's the drug company propaganda that you know, they're all they don't know it, but every psychiatrist, unless he's quite unusual, is just a marketer for the drug company. So they're marketing drug company principles. But the other thing is that they give so much neurotoxicity to patients nowadays that they can't recover. Nobody recovers, and I'm sure you didn't recover on, you know, one, two, or three, or four psychiatric drugs. It's, people don't recover. They slouch into a different alternative state based on a combination of their problems and chronic neurotoxicity. I've probably never said that so clearly. You inspire me. I mean, no, that's a dreadful, dreadful idea. And we never held it before. And I was just reading a book written in the 1800s. And the author was describing a follow-up study done on people committed for suicide to the hospitals that were being run under the old moral principles, which were fundamentally a religious, spiritual, caring, loving approach to keeping people more secure and helping them feel safe and giving them better ideas to live by and good food and avoiding drugs. And they did a follow-up of about 8,000 people who were admitted to the hospital for suicide behavior, suicidal behavior. And out of those 8,000, only 4 or 5 became completed suicides. I mean, nowadays you don't reduce the suicide rate vastly as they did to something that approaches minuscule compared to the suicide rates that we now have people under treatment. And they really help people. And this is unknown. I mean, if you said to a psychiatrist, you know, how many people would have a good recovery and how many people would suicide, if you had 8,000 people you were treating in facilities, they'd expect a much higher rate than just 4 or 5 completed suicide. So things have gotten worse, not better, as you so well know, Sarah. And we're talking to Sarah Hancock, and we want to learn some more from Sarah about her experience. I want to learn some more about, especially surrounding this program that you developed. Is this a program you could email to somebody if they wanted to look at it?
I would have to, I'll have to see about that. I have it. And I need to find out, you know, what I'm able to share, just because they consider it intellectual property. I had to sign a whole bunch of paperwork stating that it was intellectual property. So,
well, you could inquire of them, since they are not using the intellectual property, whether they would let it revert to you.
That's true. I'll have to inquire. That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, publishers do that. If they don't publish for a year or two your book, you know, you can have it revert to you. You could tell them you won't describe where what the source is, because it is really your own, and you won't represent it as relating to NAMI in any way whatsoever. But you'd like mm-hmm. to continue your work now that you're outside, and make it a really nice, warm, detailed letter like that.
Yeah.
That would be, or the other would be just ask them on a phone. I mean, gosh, you can go so many ways with it.
Yeah. So
did you have, do you want to review for us what some of the modules were about? Would be that of interest to you and our group?
Oh, sure. Let me pull up I have it right here. So there were 15 chapters in the manual. The first one was just like a family support specialist skill training intro. Then there was recovery in terms of mental health. And then there was actually working with families. There was a chapter on cultural diversity. There is a chapter on communicating. I'm sorry, I'm putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable. Communicating with families, trauma-informed systems of care, understanding transference, counter-transference, and triggers, verbal communication, written communication and body language, ethics and HIPAA, affecting change, advocacy, crisis prevention and safety, navigating through human services, and career planning, because we are helping people find employment in this field.
And this is entirely your own product, pretty much?
Yeah, it is. And I have more than 200 citations, and I was citing textbooks and peer-reviewed journal articles, and it's fun. I'm actually very proud of it. I worked really hard on it.
Yeah, yeah. How many pages is it? How many words?
It is too many pages. It's 180 pages, but that's 8.5 by 11, single spaced. So we would teach each module.
That's a full length book.
Yeah, it is a full length book.
Single spaced, a full length book, probably a short one. I wonder how many words it is. But I think you might have a book there to work on, or certainly. Information that would be useful to people. You and I can talk about it on another occasion.
Sounds good.
Sounds good to me. Sounds good. You've been doing a lot of activism. Tell your group what you're doing, because I think our audience would be very interested in being inspired to do things. I mean, you've done work in the electroshock area. Did I hear you correctly? Did you say you had 100 ECT?
I had more than 100. I've just recently, just in the past month, gotten my medical records. They were withheld from me for almost a decade. And I just recently got them, and I've gone through and I've been pulling out the data from all of the treatments, and I've up to more than 112, and I still have, I think it's 6 more months to go. I was getting it 3 times a week, 3 times a week, twice a week, twice a week, once a week, and one time I found an entry where my doctor must have stepped out, and so I had a substitute doctor, and that doctor gave it to me twice in one day, within 40 minutes of each other.
Yeah. He made twice as much money.
Yeah, exactly. It was just really disconcerting to me, especially alarming, because people can qualify for ECT now that they, if they've had 2 medications that haven't worked, and so they can qualify for ECT. And historically, we know that ECT is primarily given to older women, averaging like 52 years of age. But interestingly enough, in the past 4 months, I've actually met 5 men who have received ECT, and one of them is even younger than I am. and they've received ECT just all within the past 18 months to 2 years. So I think that there's a shift, and that shift is arising because medication is less effective, and you only need to fail, quote, fail two treatments of medication in order to qualify for ECT. So it's been very concerning to me, especially with the recent media coverage, like on 60 Minutes, Anderson Cooper did this beautiful, wonderful, let's tell the nice side of ECT, but they didn't tell the other side of ECT. And they forget to say, you know, ECT is not regulated, so every single doctor who gives it with their own methodology. And in the United States, you know, there's not only, you know, there's so many variables. There's the electric placement, there's the pulse width, there's the seizure, the type of anesthesia used. There's just so many different variables, how frequently you give it. And so we'll have people that are have nice stories about how ECT fixed their life and just six treatments. And then you have other people like me who had more than 100 treatments. And it's, I mean, I have practically lost the first 36 years of my life, like 85 to 90% of the first 36 years of my life. So it's completely changed my identity. I had to relearn who I was. I had to discover, you know, there were, because it wasn't at the time, and even now, it's only because of that class action suit that recently settled. It has never been recognized that it causes brain damage. And so I was looking for like some kind of rehabilitation program to teach me these things that I've lost, teach me some compensatory skills, teach me some strategies for, you know, this traumatic experience that I'd had. And I couldn't qualify for any of the programs in San Diego because they don't recognize ECT as having caused brain damage. So when we got the update with the thymatrin update, which I've got a funny thing about that, when they're finally saying that it can cause pervasive and permanent brain damage and permanent memory loss, finally I can take that, you know, people can take that to their local rehabilitation program and say, hey, look, I think this is my problem. Please do some neuropsych testing on me other than the MMSE and let me prove to you that I have a problem so you can help me.
Well, that is so important. I hadn't thought of that, Sarah. I hadn't thought of that. That is amazing. That is a huge breakthrough in being able to take that data and to take it to the rehabilitation centers. And folks, you can find out about this by going to my second or third most recent frequent alert on my website where I talk about this. I was the way this came about is I was hired as a medical expert, psychiatric expert, by David Karen, K-A-R-E-N, and it's the DK law firm. And I think it's in San Diego, isn't it?
No, actually, it's in L.A.
Oh, God, it's in L.A. All right. Thank you.
God, so thank you neck of the woods.
That. Compared, so it shows you how many different things I have on my mind one time. So you can go there and you can get the name David Karen, the DK law firm. That's for D&K for David Karen in Los Angeles. And I think there's even a phone number you can get on my website at the Frequent Alert. I think it's the second or third one, newest one. And you can call them and get from them an application to see if they would handle your case from anywhere in the United States. They will handle both the malpractice from anywhere in the United States, so find your lawyer, and they will handle your product liability case. And what happened is that the company challenged a summary judgment to stop the lawsuit. And the fundamental issue was that they claimed it didn't cause memory loss or brain damage and a bunch of other things. And I did the section on brain damage you know, for the summary report and memory loss. That was my function. There were other experts, but I was the one on this subject. And the judge came back with an amazing opinion in which he said that there was sufficient reasonable scientific evidence for cognitive damage and brain damage that the question could go to a jury. Wow. Never been laid out that definitively before. We've gone to juries before, but we've also been excluded on occasion, you know, by a judge who said, this doesn't cause brain damage. The doctors at Johns Hopkins say it doesn't, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And as a result now, what they're hoping is that the statute of limitations, which varies from state to state, but it's usually in a 1 or 2 year range, won't hold up anymore, folks. So if you have had ECT, or if you know somebody who's had ECT, and they get in touch with the DK law firm in Los Angeles and fill out their form, you have a possibility of getting past the statute, because this is the first time that any of the drug manufacturers have admitted that the machine causes brain damage and the machine causes memory loss. Now, they're calling the brain damage rare and the severe memory loss, like for professions, they mentioned your professional work for years, they're calling rare. But hey, that is a huge beginning. And so it's opened up a whole new era. And thanks to Sarah Haycock, I now realize it's opened up a whole new era, because you're obviously correct about pushing the rehab people, the head injury people, the TBI, the traumatic brain injury people, to take ECT. And of course, I've written extensively that ECT is traumatic brain injury. It's how it works. That's what it is.
Yeah. How it
Sarah,
works.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's how it, quote, works. The yeah. interesting thing is they were federally mandated to publish an update, and they published an update. The Cymatron people published an update on their website. That link is still active, but you can no longer access that link unless you already have the link. So you can't go to their website and find that federally regulated update, mandated update, because you cannot
What's the
access
link? Well,
that.
Hmm? Yeah, well, I think you'll find the link if you go to I'll check and see if that link is still working. But you should be able to find the link on my website on the frequent alert. Sarah, this has gone so fast. Let me quickly see if we can take a couple of questions. We've got a few people. We may not get to all of them. And if Alex is still working there, we'll go to Christina in Washington, D.C. was some general comments you wanted to make?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Bregan. It's Christina Gerke in D.C. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, you were very instrumental in teaching me a word after my daughter Natalie's death, and that was akathisia. It was the first person you were to ever tell me that word. And I'm happy to say, I guess, sorry I learned it, but happy to say that almost 6 years after Natalie's death, I've recently co-authored a course, a free course about akathisia, and it's at myths.learnupon.com, and it's accredited by the National Association of Social Workers. Anybody can take it. It's a one-hour online course so that hopefully people can avoid the kind of death that my daughter Natalie had. So I thank you for teaching me a word, and of course, I'm sorry I didn't learn it sooner.
Christina, this is terrific that you've called in. It's one of the wonderful things about this show is people I have known and loved call in, and I get relationships resumed again, but very slowly now. Give the link.
Oh, yes. It's called MISSD, M-I-S-S-D, .learnupon.com. And the course is Akathisia 101, and it is for all sorts of users, to include first responders who might misinterpret akathisia behavior in terms of like death by cop. It's for social workers who want accreditation points. It's for teachers. It's for caregivers and family members, also consumers. So it's written in a way that anybody could benefit and understand without having a medical background.
Okay, now let me get it. This is really important. So it's MISD, like misdiagnosis or something?
MISSD, no E.
B is a boy.
So it's that learnupon.com, Peter.
Yeah, MISSB dot learnupon.com.
Yes, and Dr. Bragan, I believe you've had her on the show before. MISSD, MISSD. Stands for Wendy Dolan, the widow of Stuart Dolan in Chicago, the Paxil case. MIST is the Medication-Induced Suicide Foundation in memory of Stuart Dolan. So the organization that asked me to work on the content for this CEU is the MIST Foundation.
That's great. That's wonderful. Did you have any thoughts about the show today?
You've been listening to it.
You were stuck listening to it.
No, that's really my primary purpose for calling. I just want to say a couple quick things. One, I'm very grateful to Sarah and her intellect and her compassion and your show, because I followed Sarah on Twitter for a long time, and she is eloquent and informative and very level-headed in her advocacy. So I want to thank you for having her on the show today. And then I have a quick follow-up question based upon what Sarah has done to get, help for people who've had ECT brain damage. And I was just wondering for either you or Sarah, given that now, of course, there have been some headways made into giving people opportunities to get some help for the brain damage of ECT, Dr. Bragan or Sarah, do you think that perhaps there might one day be a similar possibility for people who have had chemical brain damage for the kind of drugs, Zoloft, that my daughter and so many other people were given?
Sarah, you want to take a crack at that?
Christina, I'm so happy to hear your voice. It's so nice to hear you. We've only ever communicated through Twitter, so it's just fun to actually put a voice with a profile. I sincerely hope that that is in the future. I think that it's only a matter of time, especially because there are so many doctors in America who are prescribing medications off-label, and so many people who are becoming injured because of this off-label prescribing, let alone the polypharmacy that's going on with people with psychiatric diagnoses. And the over-medicating to kind of subdue these horrific effects like akathisia. I would have never thought that there would have been a day of reckoning for the ECT manufacturing machines, and now there has been, and I think going forward there will be even more. And I honestly, that gives me hope that other people who have been injured by these treatments, regardless of what the treatment might be, I think that there will come a day of reckoning, and everyone will have to begin to reconcile this injury, this iatrogenesis. I don't know how to pronounce that word. Peter, you can help me.
Oh, iatrogenesis.
I think that there will come a day when we can definitely... I think there will come a day where there will be a day of reckoning.
This is wonderful to hear you. And Sarah, you know this, but I just want to clear up if anybody has any misconception. Even if you take these medicines one at a time and it's according to how you're supposed to by the book, they damage the brain. Just about every psychiatric drug now, we have studies, every class of drugs, stimulants, mood disorder drugs, antipsychotic drugs, antidepressant drugs. We all the studies for each of them about brain damage from these drugs. And Sarah's certainly right in emphasizing how they're used so cavalierly off-label and so on. But even if they're used to perfection, a neurotoxin is a neurotoxin. Christina, thank you for calling in. I'm going to try to get in one more caller, so maybe you could call again in a week or two, or maybe on the next Open Friday, because I'd love to hear from you again. Are you there? Hello?
I don't think she is.
Nope, I think she went. Okay, Thomas in New York, are you there?
Yes, hello, Dr. Bregan.
Hi, we have not a long time, so I couldn't quite make out what the caller Thomas was saying. Something about how do you engage outside a clinical setting? I'm not sure what you were asking. Were you asking about me or somebody in general, or what was the question?
I guess it was a two-part question. One was, yes, partially for you, and then partially for myself, now that all this new knowledge has come my way and I hear people talking about different things regarding psychiatric medication, and I wonder myself, should I interject into a conversation? And I guess it depends on the relationship with that person. Obviously, some of these conversations I hear just in the midst of, you know, people I don't know, but some of the conversations I do, I may be an acquaintance with the person, but they may not be, you know, a family member or even a close relationship, but just an acquaintance. And I'm just wondering, what's your opinion on interjecting or, you know, something that may be different from their, current understanding of maybe putting somebody on psychiatric medication?
Okay, and I hadn't guessed that, and that's a very good question, which is, just like you said, how do you engage someone? I wasn't sure about what. How do you engage somebody about when you have some good information on psychiatric drugs to share with them and they've got misinformation? Sarah, what's your thoughts on that?
I think I would probably tell them my own experience where my doctor, after 37 different combinations of medications, came to me with tears in his eyes and literally told me that they had not yet invented the medication that would help me. And it was at that point I was doing ECT at the time. Nothing was working. I was getting worse and worse. And I realized that I had to take things into my own hands. And so I began learning from other people who lived with symptoms, learning their strategies or their tricks of the trade, if you will. And I began putting into place, you know, my own kind of treatment plan. And I found something by Dr. Seligman, Martin Seligman. It's a very easy thing, which you write down every day three things that went well, and you explain why you feel they went well. And as I did that over a period of 90 days, my perspective and my life completely changed, so much so that 8 months later, my doctor at our checkup appointment was like, this is the first 8-month stretch you've had in more than a decade where we did not alter your medication, we did not change anything, and you haven't had any inpatient stays. What changed? And I was like, well, I've learned who I am. And I believe in myself, and it's empowered me to become an agent of change in my own life. So from there, I was able to use these wellness tools and move forward in my life. So even though I had gone through 37 different combinations of medications and I had gotten progressively worse through all of that, because I found who I was and because I finally felt, you know, Peter, earlier at the beginning of the hour, you were talking about the importance of feeling and accepting that love from your family or from those around you. I previously couldn't. I didn't have a self-concept and identity and understanding, really sincere understanding of who I really am. And so helping people find that, medication is not going to change situations. It's not going to change circumstances. It's not going to change other physiologic problems. But when a person understands who they are inherently, they'll have the tools to be able to better navigate these traumas and these issues that they're facing.
We should start to wind down now. And thank you, Thomas, for calling in. I may just add to it that it's very difficult to interject into places where you haven't been invited to give advice that is threatening. And, you know, be cautious about it for your own emotional safety. And I think Sarah's approach of if you could bring up something from your own life or a family member's life or maybe something you've read and just sort of add it in to find some handle. Sarah, we're getting toward the end. Now, when we first talked about you coming on the air and then when we chatted just before you're coming on, you were really about as nervous as my guests get. You're pretty nervous. This has been a wonderful hour. I don't think there's anybody out there that's not thinking this was a really good person that I had on. And Sarah Hancock is her name. And why don't you give contact information if you would like to? I think there's people out there very much like, Christina Gerke who would love to talk to you. And if you like, give it and then repeat it and make sure you gets clear.
Certainly. You can find me on Facebook. I have a page called Psychiatric Recovery and Rehabilitation. And my website is psych, P-S-Y-C-H, recovery, and spelled out, rehabilitation.com. That's psych, recovery, and rehabilitation.com. And my you can find me on Twitter as well. My handle is at Psych Recovery. And my email is sphancock at psychrecoveryandrehab.com. That's sphancock at psychrecoveryandrehab.com. And I'm excited because this week I'm launching my podcast on emotional self-reliance. I've been caught up with some editing problems because I'm just a amateur audio editor, but I'm really excited. I've been working really hard on launching this podcast. I'm excited to bring it forward.
That's great. And Sarah, we haven't even really gotten into your background history. I mean, your recovery with all your efforts from all those drugs and over 100 ECT and the number you're still learning, I think you should look at yourself as someone who, for whatever reason, God intervened to protect, that in some way you were protected from the very worst that we would expect from all of that mistreatment and the trauma. So I think that you're in some way a person to be especially prized and treasured, and that whatever kind of power there is in this universe, and I don't pretend to know its form or its shape, I just experience it and sense the reality that there's meaning and that there's a meaningful life. And I think you've been protected. You've deserved it. And thank you for coming on the show. Thank you so much. It's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, folks. I'm saying goodbye. And let me know what you thought about this hour with Sarah Hancock. I think it was very, very special. Bye-bye now, folks.